Hi, so I'm very happy to be here today. I'm going to be talking about this paper that we put out back earlier in the summer about an exaptive level model for a decompiled quantum critical point in 1D. And I want to encourage you all to ask any questions. Please interrupt at any moment in time. And so maybe I should start off by defining what I mean by decompiled quantum critical point by first contrasting it with our understanding of regular quantum critical points. In our normal understanding of Landau phase transitions, we get from a phase A to a phase B, and phase A has symmetry G, and phase B has symmetry H. And as you tune some parameter associated to some relevant operator, you can undergo a phase.
So as you tune some parameter M associated to some relevant operator, you can get from phase A to phase B, and phase A has symmetry G, and phase B has symmetry H. And in the Landau paradigm, we have either G as a subgroup of H, or H is a subgroup of G. But there can also be cases where you have a direct transition, and these are not subgroups of each other. So for example, in the Z2 Ising transition, G might be Z2 and H might be the trivial group. And of course, that satisfies the fact that the trivial group is a subgroup of Z2. But it's very interesting when G and H don't have this kind of subgroup structure, because you might think that, oh, secretly it's simultaneously going through two transitions. And it's actually very special when it's only tuned by single relevant operator. And this is what I mean by deconfined quantum critical points. When you go between a phase A and phase B, and these symmetries don't have a subgroup structure, but the transition is still second order and is still tuned by single parameter in this stable critical point. And this is what I'm going to be talking about today. And deconfined quantum critical points have been studied a lot in the literature, mostly in the context of 2D magnetic systems, and mostly through methods in exotic field theories and numerics, partly because it has been difficult to construct analytically tractable models for them. And so that was the idea here. What is kind of the simplest model that we can construct for such an exotic phase transition? Can it be simple enough to solve exactly on a lattice? And so we're going to answer that in the affirmative in 1D. And one thing that people have found in other examples of deconfined quantum critical points is the phenomenon of intertwined symmetries. And roughly speaking, that occurs when the defects of one symmetry carry fractional charge of the other symmetry. And that was found in the original DQCPs, and that's also going to be present in what we are going to study today. And the way that we're going to find such intertwined symmetries is by looking at a particular context, which is the boundary of an SPT. So we're going to have an SPT, and this is going to be in two dimensions. And this is a vacuum, the boundary to the vacuum. And this SPT has some symmetry, so we're going to consider, for example, Z2 cos Z2 symmetry. And there is a huge literature about SPTs in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but the fact that I'm going to use is that there's an anomaly on the boundary, on the 1 plus 1D boundary. And what this anomaly means is that there are 4 possible edge theories. So. First, we can be gapless and symmetric. Second, let's call this A and B so that we can differentiate between them. We can spontaneously break the first Z2 symmetry. Our third option is to spontaneously break the second symmetry. And our fourth option is to spontaneously break them both. And what we're going to find is we're going to find a deconfined quantum critical point between these two phases. And the intuition for why we would expect a direct transition between these two phases is the following. The anomaly of this SPT means that domain walls of Z2A carry fractional charge of the Z2B. So you can imagine starting off in a phase where you've spontaneously broken the Z2A and you're symmetric under Z2B. Now what you can do is you can try proliferating the domain walls of the Z2A in order to symmetrize with respect to the symmetry. But what happens is certainly you can't get into a phase that's symmetric under both because that's prohibited by the anomaly. And second, as you proliferate the domain walls of the Z2A, you also proliferate charge of the Z2B. So naturally you would fall into this phase where you're symmetric under Z2A or you spontaneously break the Z2B. Now that's kind of a high level idea of what happens, but in order to make this concrete, we're gonna map this into a Z4 spontaneous symmetry breaking transition. And because we know everything about this transition, we can understand all the critical properties of this deconfined quantum critical point. So that's kind of what we're gonna be doing today.
Sorry, just to make sure I understand. So when you say this gets you an exactly solvable model, the exact part, is the exact part the mapping, or even after the mapping, the model is still, the transition is still exactly tractable?
So this mapping is exact. And there's a particular, so the Z4 spin chain has a line of a critical line, and there's a particular point on that critical line that's exactly solvable. So that we'll go through that exactly solvable point. Okay. So because this is not too important, I will erase this. The first step in this procedure is to define the edge theory. And I should mention that this is a edge theory of a 2 plus 1D, so it's a 1 plus 1D theory. It's still a tensor product Hilbert space, it's just the symmetries are not on site. So I'm gonna define our SPD edge theory as follows. First, you have to define the Hilbert space. So I'm just gonna define the Hilbert space as a 1D spin chain. And I'm going to include 2 qubits per unit cell. So this is 1 unit cell, and I've kind of staggered them just for ease of notation. And these are gonna be labeled by sigmas, and these are gonna be taus. So for example, sigma x, j, and tau x, j plus 1/2, are gonna act as Pauli operators on these qubits. Now we have to define our symmetries. So let's define our first symmetry. Remember that the SPT has Z2A, plus Z2B symmetry. So we can define UA as just product of sigma xj. So this is just a spin flip on all the sigmas. And UB is going to take a little bit of a different form. And this is not on site because we're describing the edge theory of an SPT. You can check that both of these are Z2 symmetries. This is obviously a Z2 symmetry. And this one, because if you have a closed system, you always have an even number of misalignments between the sigma Zs. So this will always give you an even number of I's. So it's also a Z2 symmetry. And what we want to say is that the mixed anomaly between the two Z2 symmetries means that a domain wall, or two domain walls of the UA symmetry is actually a UB charge. And so we can do that very concretely by looking at an example of a Hamiltonian that spontaneously breaks this UA symmetry. And you can see that this Hamiltonian has two degenerate ground states. I can just draw them out. So let's call them psi1. It's just all the sigmas pointing up and the taus in the plus tau x. And then the second ground state is going to be like this. Okay, so you can see that these are the two ground states of this Hamiltonian. And they spontaneously break the symmetry and respect the symmetry. And now, what does a state with two domain walls look like? It looks like this. what you do is you just kind of patch these states together in two places, so it will look something like this. And you can see that there's a domain well here and a domain well here. And what you can also see is that if you act this UB on this two domain well state, you'll have a charge. And this is kind of weird because if you just have two Z2 symmetries that are just completely independent, then of course if you have two domain walls of one of the Z2 symmetries, they're going to annihilate, and it's going to be the same as having no domain walls. But here, because of the anomaly, you have two domain walls fusing to a charge of the other symmetry. And what this means is that unlike the usual case where if you have this kind of symmetry, you have a Z2 cos Z2 fusion structure of the domain walls. Instead, you actually have a Z4 fusion structure of the domain walls. So what that means is you actually have four different kinds of domain walls. You have this, this, so what this is this is a no domain wall state. This is a single UA domain wall, because you flip one of the spins. This is, if you have two of the Z2A domain walls, they fuse into a charge. So if you want to keep your quantum number under the UB, you have to flip this tau. And now this is a composite of the both. So this is your four different kinds of domain walls, and they have a Z4 fusion structure. And because you have four different kinds of domain walls that have a Z4 fusion structure, this indicates that you can map the system to a Z4 spin chain, which also has four different kinds of domain walls that have a Z4 fusion structure. So let's describe what the Z4 spin chain is. This is just going to be the generalization of the Z2 Ising spin chain. And so to describe this, it's just going to be a four-dimensional local Hilbert space in a 1D spin chain. So the operators that act on each of these spins can be generated by the clock and shift operators that satisfy the following algebra. And they commute on different sites. And you can actually also write them out explicitly. So this is just going to be like the Z4 generalization of sigma z. This is I minus 1 minus I. And then the Sj is just going to permute the different. This is like the Z4 generalization of sigma x. This is going to permute the different eigenstates of the clock operator. It's just a permutation matrix. And there's going to be a global Z4 symmetry, and that's generated by UZ4 equals product of Sj. And in the Ising spin chain, we can draw the eigenstates of the sigma z by kind of up and down arrows. So now I can use a notation for, now we have four different states. So I'm going to do up, left, down, and right to denote these four states. And we can draw the four different kinds of domain walls as follows. So these kinds of domain walls are measured by a domain wall measurement operator, which is Cj dagger Cj plus 1. And you can check that this will give you eigenvalue 1, I, minus 1, and minus I for this operator. Maybe I should do this. CJ plus one, yeah. So these domain walls in the Z4 spin chain carry eigenvalues under this domain wall measurement operator, just like how in the Ising spin chain, domain walls carry eigenvalue plus or minus one under sigma z, sigma z. Okay, so this fully defines our Z4 spin chain. It defines the symmetry in the Hilbert space and the kinds of domain walls. So what we want to do is we want to do an exact mapping between this Hilbert space and the Hilbert space of our SPT edge theory. So to do that, in order to do that, what we need to do is we need to find what this domain wall measurement operator maps onto in the SPT edge theory. And we also need to know what this domain wall creation operator maps onto in the SPT edge theory. You can recall that in the Ising spin chain, of course, you can create opposite domain walls by doing a sigma x. And then you'll create a domain wall here and a domain wall here. So this SJ, the shift operator, does a similar thing in the Z4 spin chain. Okay, so to do this operator mapping, we want an operator that gives you eigenvalue 1i minus 1 and minus I for our four domain wall configurations. And you can easily check that this will map onto this operator here. I should mention that I've chosen a certain explicit definition of the symmetry, but you could have chosen other ones as long as they satisfy the same anomaly. Okay, so now we want to find what this operator maps onto, which is a little bit more non-trivial, but we can do this. Okay, so the idea is that what the SJ operator does is it creates opposite domain walls on either side of the site J. So suppose that we start off with two of the trivial domain walls. What we want to do is we want to apply SJ, and then this is going to be the site J, by the way. And we want to apply SJ, and that will map us onto a state that has domain wall I and minus I, which you can match with up there. And then when we apply SJ again, this will take us to the state minus 1, minus 1. And then applying the shift operator again will map us to and then finally, applying shift operator again, we'll map you back. So this is the action that we want for our domain wall creation operator. And what you can do is you can write that as follows. So OK, this is going to be a little bit long, but you can show that it works. Okay, so.
Sorry, the beginning of the second line, is that multiply or?
Yeah, this is multiply. What this says is, you can check that this works. What this says is, if the two sigmas on the left are aligned, then you don't flip the tau. But if they are, I should do this. But if they are anti-aligned, then you flip the tau. And similarly, you can just check that's the operator that takes you in the cycle.
I think maybe you're missing a tau on the second line.
Oh yeah, you're right. Okay. So it's a bit long, but you can see that this can be just derived by looking at the action that you want it to perform. And this looks like it's a local mapping. So you've mapped some local operators to other local operators. But it's not actually fully local. It's kind of like a Kramers-Vanier. So you can see that it will map some string operators to local operators and local operators to string operators. So what you also want to check is the action of this mapping on the global operators. So for example, you'll see that if you do this, that will map onto UB. And if you take this, that will map onto UA. Because somehow if you multiply all of these operators together, all these messy parts cancel, and you'll end up with just a product of sigma xj.
The first line that maps to UB, isn't that identity if you multiply every j?
Yeah, so this is because it's a map string operators to local operators and local operators to string operators. Right, because if you do this operator, maps onto this. So if you multiply them all out, you'll get the UB.
Oh, sorry, but I was asking something much dumber. Uh-huh. So if I just take CI, C dagger J, C, J plus one,
yeah,
multiply all the J's.
Yeah.
So for each J, C dagger C is one, right?
Yeah, yeah. So this means that the UB, the different sectors of UB map onto boundary conditions of the Z4 spin chain. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm going to say now. OK, maybe I can even squeeze it in here. So what we've actually done is we map the UA equals plus or minus 1 and UB equals 1 to product of SJ equals plus or minus 1 and periodic boundary conditions. And the UA equals plus or minus 1 and UB equals minus 1 to product of SJ equals plus or minus one and anti-periodic boundary conditions.
So this is like Kramers one here.
Yeah. So what we've really done is, so in the usual Z4, in the usual Z4 spin chain, right? If we draw, and this direction is the symmetry sector, and then boundary conditions here, you can have one I minus one. A minus I, and then in the boundary conditions, you can also have one I minus one and minus I. The usual Z4 spin chain, you might consider a single boundary condition and all of the symmetry sectors. But now we have these sectors. And so you can either just sum over different sectors, which I'm going to be that's going to be my intuition for going into this. The summing over different sectors won't change the critical properties, like the critical exponents. Or you can couple the Z4 spin chain to a Z2 gauge field. So what that means is just you do minimal coupling. So you modify CJ dagger CJ plus 1 to CJ dagger mu ZJ J plus 1 CJ plus 1. And then you apply the gauge constraint, so mu x j minus 1 j mu x j j plus 1 equals s j squared. So you can either couple it to a Z2 gauge field, or you can just sum over the different sectors. OK.
Just make sure I understand. So it's a Z4 spin chain coupled to Z2 gauge field, so the global symmetry is the Z4 part, because you mod out the Z2 center, so that gives you a Z2, but the Z2 gauge field also gives you a Z2.
Yeah, so that absorbs the boundary condition into the Z2 gauge, the flux parity of the Z2 gauge field.
That's why the gap phase, okay, breaks the flux Z2 symmetry, and the Higgs phase breaks the Z2 symmetry of the matter field. That's basically how you get the D2CP.
Yeah.
something.
Yeah, or we can, I'll write it out explicitly now. So this is actually going to be a very powerful mapping, because we're going to use this mapping to show that regardless of the particular model, any theory that undergoes the Z4 spontaneous symmetry breaking transition under this operator, exact operator mapping, will undergo DQCP. So the idea is that, so let's do. So the idea is that the Z4 spin chain has three gap phases. So you can be Z4 spontaneous symmetry broken, you can be Z4 symmetric, or you can break the Z4 down to a Z2 subgroup. These are the three possibilities. And in order to diagnose what phase you're in, you can use order and disorder parameters. So an order parameter is just something that is non-zero in the ordered phase. So I'm going to define this. As just this two-point correlator. And then the disorder operator, or the disorder parameter, is something that's non-zero in the symmetric or the disordered phase. So this is going to be defined as follows. And so here we know that the order parameter is going to be non-zero, and the disorder parameter equals zero. And here the order parameter is equal to zero, and the disorder parameter is not zero. And here both of them are zero. So you use these to diagnose what phase you're in. But now what you can check is that under this operator mapping, this is just going to be UB acting on some interval. And this is UA acting on some interval. And so this is a UB, Z2, B disorder parameter. And this is a Z2, A disorder parameter. So now you can check that here, because the order parameter is not equal to zero, that means that the Z2B disorder parameter is not equal to zero. So it's Z2B symmetric. And then by similar argument, this disorder parameter is zero. So the Z2A disorder parameter is zero. So it is Z2A spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then now, using the same arguments here, you can show that this is going to be Z2 A symmetric and Z2 B spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then here, you spontaneously break both symmetries. And so then this means that regardless of the particular model or the particular Hamiltonian that you use to tune this transition, any model that tunes through this transition will then map onto a deconfined quantum critical point on this side. And I should also mention that this is actually the only way I know to rigorously prove that the Z2 Gauss Z2 SPT can't have a symmetric gap boundary. Because people say that all the time, like, oh, it's an SPT, so the boundary can't be symmetric and gapped. But now you can see that because of this exact mapping, and we know these are the only only phases on this side, there's just no phase on the other side that is symmetric under both symmetries.
Actually, sound, of course, very plausible, but how do you know exactly that these are the only possible gapped phases?
Well, because it's a non-anomalous Z4 symmetry, so you can only break subgroups of it, and Those are the only gap phases.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's, yeah, no SPTs or anything of Z4. So these are the only possibilities that we have, and we see that we've mapped this symmetry breaking transition onto our deconfined quantum critical point. And now we can use our broad, our very vast understanding of Z4 spontaneous symmetry breaking transitions. We know that there's actually a whole line of critical points in the Z4 spin chain. And that maps onto a whole line of deconfined quantum critical points. And there's a particular point on that critical line that's exactly solvable. So the model for this critical point that I'm going to use is very simple. It's just the Z4 clock model. And as you see, as you tune alpha through alpha equals a half, this is going to be Z4 spontaneous symmetry breaking, and this is Z4 symmetric. And now what we can do is we can map this operator mapping onto some HA, which lives in the SPT edge theory. So it's just some combinations of sigmas and taus. And we can map this to an HB, which also lives in the SPT edge theory. And I'm not going to write them out explicitly because, as you can see, it can be a little bit long, but it's going to be, it has the same commutation relations and everything as these operators here. And now what you can do is you can write H equals and now as you tune alpha, you go through a phase transition at alpha equals a half between spontaneously breaking the Z2A and spontaneously breaking the Z2B. And this is actually a particularly nice model because we can actually do an exact mapping from this Z4 spin chain, this model here, to two copies of Ising models. And so we can always map the Z4 spin chain to two copies of Ising models with some coupling. But at this particular point, they're actually decoupled. So under an exact operator mapping, you can actually map Cj dagger Cj plus 1 plus Hc onto UZj mu z j plus 1 plus rho z j rho z j plus 1 and s j dagger plus s j gets mapped onto mu x j plus rho x j, where these are now Pauli matrices. And these don't actually have anything to do with these sigmas and taus. They're just other kind of Ising spin chains. But you can do this mapping exactly. And then you can see that as you undergo this transition at alpha equals a half, that's just going to be two simultaneous Ising transitions. And so now,
Z2 symmetry is, now you're back to Z2 cross Z2, but it's a totally different Z2 cross Z2 from the original ones.
Yeah, so now it's just a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, but these are not the same Z2 cross Z2 as the
original. So is that mapping local, or is it?
Yeah, so this is a fully local mapping. I can write it down explicitly for each CJ operator and SJ operator.
So how does the Z4 symmetry act on this? To decouple icing.
Yeah, so if you map the product of SJ, that will actually map into something that isn't so tidy on this side.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Basically, the idea behind this mapping, which I can say a bit briefly. Okay. Is that you can map the CJ operator as e to the minus. Mu z j plus I rho z j. So now this is mapping this one, which can take, basically this will give you the real and imaginary components in the complex plane. And then if these are both one, then you want to rotate it back so that this is map onto one, one. And then this is going to map onto one, one, and this is going to be mapped onto e to the minus I pi over 4, 1 minus I. So basically all these points, remember I showed the four eigenstates of CJ as up, left, down, and right. So you just map them onto these with the two plus or minus one eigenvalues and plus or minus one eigenvalues of these two poly operators. And then you can look at this, if it's in this state, what does the SJ need to do to flip it to the next one and permute them? But yeah, so this is going to be, you can work out the action of the Z4 symmetry. I recall that it wasn't super nice. Okay, so maybe I'll keep that. So now, using this mapping, we can get the critical properties exactly. So we know that, just because we know all the critical properties of the Ising critical point, so now we know that at the critical point, the correlation length is going to go as where nu equals 1, because it's just the sum of those two mass terms. And we also know that sigma z, the order parameter for the z2a is just going to be like this. And you can show that this is just going to be equal to this is equal to this operator. And now under this new mapping to the two Ising spin chains, this will map onto rho z I, rho z j, mu z I, mu z j. But because these are decoupled Ising spin chains, we can just write this as rho z I, rho z j, mu z I, mu z j. And so we know that this goes as because each of these goes as in addition, we can show that tau z I tau z j. So this is the order parameter for the other symmetry, the other z2 symmetry. By a similar kind of exercise, you can easily show that this also behaves in the same way at the critical point. And what this means is that there's actually an emergent symmetry at the critical point that permutes the Z2A and Z2B symmetry. And that emergent symmetry actually descends from the Kramers-Vanier duality of the Z4 spin chain. One more point about this mapping. I had mentioned in the Z4 spin chain that you have to project into the, you have to do a Z2 orbifold. So then the sector is onto these two Ising spin chains that you're looking at that correspond to that Z2 orbifold would be product of rho x u x equals 1, and the same boundary conditions for the two Ising spin chains. So that's what that orbifold will correspond to.
I see. So if I move away from the decoupled point, presumably I get some orbifold complex boson, right? Is that it?
You mean if we move away from this exactly solvable point?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you can then you will have some other critical exponents. It will be one.
Right.
But it will be the orbifold of the complex boson. Yeah.
So what would that boundary condition look like in that theory?
Well, you can still, even away from the exactly solvable point, it's still going to be two Ising models, but with some coupling. And that coupling will modify the critical exponent.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so many of you know there is a Kramers-Bonnier duality of the Z4 spin chain that maps the ordered and disordered phases. And I just erased what I wanted to use, but okay. But famously, that Kramers-Bonnier duality is not unitary, because as we saw, if you map the ordered and disordered phase, you have a Z4 ground state degeneracy, and here you have a trivial ground state degeneracy. So it's not unitary, and it's not so. But when we did the operator mapping, we mapped a twofold ground state degeneracy. So, oh, sorry, four ground state. Twofold ground state degeneracy onto another state phase that has twofold ground state degeneracy. So now what you can show is that in the SPT edge theory, the Kramers-Bonnier duality turns into something that is unitary. And it's locality preserving on all the operators, not just the local operators. And you can actually write this emergent symmetry and its action on all of the operators in the SPT edge theory exactly.
Just to make sure, for this emergent symmetry, is it only true at the decoupling point, or is it true in general for the orbifold compact boson?
It will be true in general, but there are operators that would break the symmetry that are irrelevant in general.
That are irrelevant?
Yeah. So that's why I say it's an emergent symmetry.
Yeah.
So this symmetry takes kind of an interesting form. Let me call this symmetry UC because it occurs at the critical point. And this can be written as U times T a half. So this is just a finite depth local unitary. And this T a half is like a half translation. And what I mean by a half translation is, if you recall our SPT edge theory, we have two qubits per unit cell. So what the half translation does is T a half sigma equals tau or omega equals x, y, z. And similarly, so it just swaps the sigmas and the taus. You can see that what this UC does is it permutes the UA and UB up there. So what it also does is it permutes, so we had CJ, dagger CJ plus 1, we map this onto a 3-spin operator, right, under our operator mapping, which I think I've erased, which I have erased. And then we map this SJ to a 5 spin operator. Because recall, we had like 3 sigmas and 2 taus, so this is some 5 spin operator. So now what this does is the first step, let's start off with the 3 spin operator. So we have this 3 spin operator that corresponds to CJ, dagger CJ plus 1 in the SPT edge theory. We're going to do a half translation. So this then maps onto an operator that looks like this. And then what the finite depth local unitary does is it maps this onto our 5 spin operator that's supported on 3 sigmas and 2 taus. And you can obtain exactly how it acts on all of these sigmas and taus in the SPT edge theory. And it's a little bit of a weird symmetry because it has this half translation, but it's not so surprising because the original Kramer's 1A duality also squares through translation. So you can show that this squares through translation. But it's really a unitary locality preserving symmetry here. And so now this kind of concludes our discussion of this deconfined quantum critical point. We have discussed all the critical properties, the critical exponents, its emergent symmetries. And this is kind of nice because it demystifies something that seemed to be very mysterious. And there are a few ways in which you can generalize this construction. Some of them.
Actually, before you go on further, maybe I just ask, for the fact that this guy squares to translation, is that inevitable or is it a feature of this model? So
that's a good question. I think that probably you can get one that doesn't square to a translation because you can consider the boundary of a D4 SVT, which precisely has the mixed anomaly between the Z2s and the other one that swaps the 2 Z2s. But maybe in this Hilbert space, you have to have the translation. I don't really see a way to avoid it in this Hilbert space. Okay, so I have kind of talked about this whole discussion using the perspective of domain walls and just the 1D theory. But you can also extend it to various other kinds of systems. The easiest and most natural extension is to other kinds of mixed anomalies, right? And so that would be a system with ZNI plus ZNJ symmetry. And you can show that the mixed anomalies in this case are classified by some element of where NIJ is the greatest common divisor of NI and NJ. And so you can show that they're classified by these kinds of these elements. And what you can also show is that if the greatest common divisor of K and Nij is 1, then this system with a mixed anomaly will map onto a ZNINJ spin chain. This is actually important because if this is not satisfied, then in general, this will map onto a different spin chain. And then your deconfined quantum critical point might not actually map onto a Landau transition. So this is actually important. But you can show that this is always the case if this GCD property is satisfied. And the way that we...
So when this co-prime condition is not satisfied, what happens? You said you can still map to something.
Yeah, so an example is if you have Z4 cross Z4, if K is equal to 2, then this will map onto a Z8 cross Z2 spin chain.
Okay.
And then this DQCP will actually map onto like a non-Landau transition because you're not you undergo two spontaneous symmetry breaking transitions.
Does it mean does that imply that your original DQCP will not be a single transition or?
It will basically mean that you can't. Okay, so even if you construct this mapping to a ZNI NJ, you have to be careful because there can be other operators at the critical point that are relevant. So even if you can get this mapping, you need to make sure that it's a stable critical point. And then if you map it to this, it means that likely there's not a stable, I mean, there isn't a stable transition. But yeah, you can show that if this is satisfied, then you can map it to a ZNI NJ spontaneous symmetry breaking transition. And the way that we actually got the easiest way I know to derive this is by actually looking at the 2+1D gauge theory. You can show that you can get the same kind of understanding, but not the microscopic model, from the fact that twisted Z2 quasi Z2 gauge theory is dual to untwisted Z4 gauge theory. So this is obtained by using similar kinds of arguments for other gauge theories. And I should mention that an interesting case is when the GCD of Ni and Nj is 1. So of course you can have k equals 1 and Nij equals 1. In that case, there's no anomaly. So it's kind of weird, but you can still have a DQCP. So an example is like Z2 cross Z3. That will map onto a Z6 spin chain. And you can show that this spontaneous symmetry breaking transition will map onto this DQCP even when there's no anomaly, which is kind of weird. But it has to do with the fact that you can always attach kind of integer charge to domain levels. But if you want to do something like this, it's kind of known in the literature that if you take the clock model that we had, and then we generalize this to Z6, and we tune this alpha parameter, so we had H equals 1 minus alpha. And this can now be any Zn clock and shift variables. But it's known that if you have this is greater than Z4, so for example Z6, then you won't have a direct transition. And so what you'll actually have is you'll have a floating gapless phase. So what you'll have is, as you tune alpha, you'll have gapless and symmetric and SSB. So now we need to kill this gapless phase. So in order to do that, all these symmetries are internal, so you can just map this onto HA. You can disorder the system, so you can add CJ, HJ. Where these are randomly distributed. And what you can show is that as this disorder goes to infinity, this gapless region closes up, and you'll get a strong disorder to find quantum critical point. So this is going to be alpha. So this is maybe the first example of a disordered deconfined quantum critical point that we can actually understand exactly, because you can get all of the critical properties from strong disorder RG. And that there are probably other ways to kill this gapless region, but this is one way. You can probably add like next nearest neighbor or something like that terms. But yeah, so this is one extension. You can study other kinds of mixed anomalies. What you can also do is study other kinds of anomalies. So this is what's called the type 2 cocycle. You can study type 3 cocycles. And then that might give rise to interesting kinds of deconfined multi-critical points, because you'll be mapping onto non-abelian spin chains. And then, of course, it would always be interesting to go to higher dimensions and see if you can obtain higher dimensional 2+1D deconfined quantum critical points by setting models similar to this. Of course, if you only stick with discrete unitary symmetries, then you won't really have a shot in 2+1D, because Here, you really need a map between the charges and the domain walls. In 2 plus 1D, the domain walls are lines, the charges are points. But it's possible that you can use continuous symmetries where the vortices are points and the charges are points. So those are some of the ways you can generalize this. But that's all I have for today.
I actually, can you say a little bit more about the Z6 thing? So let me try to understand. So when you say there's an entire gap whose phase, I presume in that CFT, the symmetry allowed operators are all irrelevant. And then once you, but that would mean that if I turn on weak disorder, those operators will also be Harris irrelevant anyway, right? So do you need strong disorder for this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what you do is you go to the infinite disorder limit and you do perturbation theory on the lattice in terms of assuming infinite disorder.
And the strong disorder RG will go back to the infinite disorder limit.
So what you assume is that you have all of these couplings and it's infinitely disordered, so you can find the strongest coupling and perturb around that and just continue going through that hierarchy, and then you can get all the critical exponents there.
Okay, I see. So,
this was done in like a credible paper by Daniel Fisher, and then for the Z2 case, and then Senthil and collaborator show that the same infinite disorder fixed point occurs for any ZN clock model.
I see. Any other question?
So for that clock model, when you read in terms of tau and sigma, is the Hamiltonian non-local?
So it's still going to be a local Hamiltonian because all of these will map onto local operators. So it will just be a sum of local operators.
And all of those you talk about is on the boundary of SPT, right?
Yeah, so it's still like a tensor product Hilbert space. It's still a well-defined 1 plus 1D theory. It's just the symmetry is not realize in an on-site way, which is why I consider it at the boundary of an SPT.
Can I think about local symmetries, like one domain will attach to another's charge, but both of them are local? I guess it's impossible to find such a system, right?
C2
both being local. But
that would be like an SPT, right? Is that what you're talking about? Like we have Z2 cross Z2 symmetry?
No, I'm talking about like one dimensional chain. So like suppose I have Z2 cross Z2, it's a, like both of Z2 are local symmetries. Can one, can the charge of one like attach to the domain wall of another one?
So that's the case in the SPT. But then if you want it to be fractional charge, which is the case here, because you really want two domain walls, which would usually be trivial to give you a charge. If it's integer charge, then two domain walls would still be just trivial. So
I see.
If you want the fractional charge, then it has to be non-on-site.
Okay, I see.
I guess for Z2 plus Z3, you can have, in principle, you can have completely on-site stuff.
Yeah. This is all on-site. It was actually really weird when we thought about it, because I was like, oh, I thought there has to be an anomaly. But in principle, you don't need an anomaly.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
I think there are some also known examples.
Yeah, I think like Tarun Grover and Senthil.
Yeah, you can avoid anomalies in some way.
Yeah, just somehow an anomaly just makes it more likely. But
even in those examples, I guess there are examples where the UV has no anomaly, but the IR has some emergent anomaly. I don't think even that's completely necessary for this story, for this kind of non-Landau transition. But for example, for this case, is there some emergent anomaly there? Okay, it's an orbital compact boson. That
yeah. If you call that an anomaly, then but and the UV is completely just on-site symmetries. So.
Thank you. Any other question? Okay, if not, let's thank